everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, in Walker's Inestimable Words, a board game podcast about board games. With me is the aforementioned man, the myth, the legend, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello. I'm doing very well, Mark. Better than yesterday.
I'm glad to hear it. Yesterday was rough, wasn't it?
Food poisoning is great.
Food poisoning, great. Games bad was very much the agenda for yesterday, but I'm glad you've recovered.
Like, how many times do I show up to games even though I'm half dead? This is like the one time, I think, in the last 15 years that I purposely passed.
It's a good point. You could be mauled by a bear outside the entrance of your place of work, and you would show up with any missing limbs and apologize for the mess.
Probably.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So it's very good to have you with us. We are going to be talking about board games this week. We are going to talk about the Eurus, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to have our topic. And the topic is games that make you uncomfortable. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly 1 year ago, we reviewed a game called Dead Reckoning. This is another John D. Clare sort of card building system. For those who don't know, he has a lot of games that have these clear cards that slide into sleeves that sort of transparent through each other. So it creates a whole card that is super thick. Not too bad. You sort of, sometimes you know when you're shuffling, sometimes you don't. And in this one, you are a pirate. You're moving around, you're collecting treasure, you're attacking the other players. There's like a soft story that goes on in the background.
That is the one area that I will give Dead Reckoning credit for. I didn't particularly hate it, but as far as John D. Clare games go, I'd actually say it was above average, but it didn't really grab me. But one thing that Dead Reckoning is doing, as well as a number of other related games, is they're trying to have a sort of more low-key approach to campaign systems, where it's just you add a couple of scenario cards here and there, and they're just going to provide a little bit of modification to how the game is going to proceed. Because Dead Reckoning's campaign was very much low-impact. People could jump in, jump out. Wasn't a huge deal. The contours of the scenario were minimal. Now, by the same token, you therefore don't get the full sense of a narrative, as you say. It was very, very light. But quite frankly, unless the narrative is going to be particularly gripping, and let's be frank, it almost never is, I would rather it be low impact and maximum flexibility, but ultimately that dovetails with one of Dead Reckoning's chief defects and one of the main reasons why I've never even bothered to think about it since is that, you know, the sessions were a little long, it was a little clumsy, it didn't really hang together very well.
Mark, I think I'm going to take like sort of start making a list.
Mm-hmm.
When we play games that handcuff your movement, where a major part of the game is moving around a map,
yep,
and they constantly handcuff you every time you try to do it.
Sure.
And whether or not that influences our decision, whether it's a good game or whether we enjoyed it or didn't enjoy it. Because this is yet another game that has this, I won't say giant map, but this grid that you're moving around. And it's like this constant, painful slog around this map. This is how I felt anyway.
I don't remember feeling that way. I do feel that way about a number of games, but let's be frank, there are some games that we enjoy where the difficulty of getting from point A to point B is part of the actual game. So that applies to recent games like Sand. That also applies to games like Mage Knight, and that also applies to games like Project Elite. So it's not a universal generalization, just I don't remember finding the movement in Dead Reckoning difficult, but I can respect the fact that you might not have enjoyed it. I also didn't like the player versus player combat. I don't think it was not handled particularly well. It was all right.
Yeah, this was a giant crowdfunding campaign by AEG Games. It had this cool ship tower, so whenever you did damage, you rolled cubes down this ship mast, I guess, or sails, and they would land in these different wells and do different things. I thought that was cool.
It was fun. I wish it had been used more. I like the spectacle of it. That was enjoyable. Suffice to say, as a summary, you have not played Dead Reckoning since we reviewed it.
I do not think
Neither
so.
Neither have I. I traded away my copy in point of fact.
Yeah,
so.
And we've even had a copy here this whole time. So it's not as though it not being here was something that kept us
I thought
away.
That was Warm Boy's copy.
It was, but it sat here.
Like
I'm saying it was here, so it's sure. Not as though we were limited on playing it because you didn't have your copy.
Yeah, you should give Warm Boy back his game.
I think since he's taken it recently.
Okay.
But the majority of the time it was here.
Excellent. And that was Dead Reckoning by John D. Clare, published by AEG, pursuant to successful crowdfunding in 2022. Now, on to the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
We played this unknown game from a new designer called Tigris and Euphrates, designed by Reiner Knizia, And the one we did, well, the version we played was the Hans M. Gluck version?
No, it was not.
No?
Sorry. No.
I assumed it was.
No, this was the Pegasus Spiel edition.
Gotcha.
A lot of the Knizia Ubersnoots swear by the Hans M. Gluck edition. I do not find it my preferred edition. The reason why is because for a perfect edition of Tigris and Euphrates, this is, of course, very important, it being the greatest game ever made, I find it very, very important to have artwork on the tiles that is simultaneously pleasing and allows you to easily eyeball how many tiles there are going to be in any given kingdom for potential conflicts. And the Hans M. Gluck edition had the color centered in the middle of the tile rather than the edge of the tile, and I thus found it less functional than many alternatives. And so while I appreciate a lot of aspects of the Hans M. Gluck edition, I prefer the Pegasus Spiel edition for the art. It was also the first edition that had the alternate map side and the new variant buildings. And so I'm very, very pleased with my edition, independently of the fact that Reiner Knizia has autographed the rulebook.
Very nice.
Yes, it was a birthday gift from Dewey. It was very thoughtful.
Very thoughtful. And so I don't know what else to say. If you have not played Tigris and Euphrates, then you need to play it at least once. Like I said while we were playing it, I could play this game only and still be happy. It is a fantastic game where the board state is constantly changing. You are threatening areas. You are or making people second guess. You are pushing towards getting treasures. All of this tension and when is the game going to end. The scoring system is fantastic. Everything about it, I enjoy.
I typically overvalue treasures, and I felt very liberated this time, the session, because I deliberately chose to not go after them too hard. A lot of the early game is motivated by some of the treasures. You don't know what colors you're going to be weak in. You don't know what points you're going to be strong in. And so getting treasures is a great hedge against that. And with the relatively open geography of the opening state of Tigris and Euphrates, I really do appreciate the fact that it gives you something to focus on. It's just one of those many brilliant areas of design. But this time, although I set myself up to get some treasures, I never did. They were frequently snagged by either you or Dr. Stallone. And so initially I felt very frustrated by that. But I was, you know what? Take a page out of Walker's book. Try something different. Don't go for treasures. Another thing that varies considerably game by game of Tigris and Euphrates is how many monuments get constructed. This game, there were only two monuments, and they were constructed, one of them halfway through the game and the other one kind of two-thirds through the game. And what's strange, though, is that they were not contested. Primarily due to the points they were generating, the colors they were generating, were not of interest to other players. But, that having been said, there were lots of conflicts. A couple of huge, very consequential conflicts. A fair amount of player A setting up player B and C to fight amongst each other or threatening that so as to influence future plays. I agree entirely. Tigris and Euphrates is a brilliant expression of Reiner Knizia's design genius. And I agree that it is the kind of game that if you had to think of only one game to play in the hobbyist universe, I think it would be very, very high up there, if not the absolute top. So I was very happy to get it back to the table, but very sad to see that my copy is starting to have the edges of its tiles fray.
Oh, no.
Which is unfortunate. I'm going to try to see. It's been out of print for about 10 years, this edition. Tigris and Euphrates is, broadly speaking, out of print, which is desperately shameful. But I would very much like to replace the tiles that I've got. Now, I was able to replace the bag that came with the original edition because a hole developed. We got to play with the So Very Wrong About Games drawstring bag.
Hashtag swag.
Hashtag merch. Yeah, there's merchandise available. Yeah. It worked really well. It's a perfect size for Tigris and Euphrates. And so I was very pleased to be playing with a branded bag. It was nice.
It was a three-player game, for those who care. That's Tigris and Euphrates.
Dr. Stallone, as I mentioned, is in town, and he requested to play Antica 2, and one hardly needs to twist my arm to play Antica 2. Let me tell you the story of how Antica 2 always works. You explain the way the game works. There are a couple of questions that typically come up, typically like, well, is there a sub-mechanism for this? To which the answer is almost always no. One of the most common questions is there any way to transport land units with boats? Because it's a Civ-type game. You've got all the trappings of Civ-type games. You've got your infrastructure. You've got your military units of two different types. And you start wondering about this, that, and the other. And he says, nope. We don't have that. We don't need that. The rules are just as simple as they sound. Then, about 5 to 10 minutes into the actual playing of the game, people start observing, wow, these turns are really fast. Yes, they are. We were playing with 5 players, but the turns are so incredibly snappy that the game just moves at a lightning pace. It's very, very satisfying and very, very pleasing. Despite the fact that turns are so quick, you still feel like you're doing things on your actual turn. And then, at the end of the game, everyone starts pulling out their phones and asking the same question. Where can I buy this? Is this still in print? Is this available? Yeah. Antica 2 wins friends wherever it goes. This was a redevelopment of Matt Gert's first design, Antica. And I'd happily play Antica, but Antica 2, I think, is slightly better in every way. It's got a number of subtle refinements. But if you've only got the first edition will serve you just fine. It's a little more complicated with respect to military conquests. It's like one rough edge in a game almost entirely devoid of rough edges. And I think the improvement to military is one of the key advantages of Antica 2. But nonetheless, I would happily play any version of Antica. Matt Gertz has designed some of my all-time favorite games. And being able to play Tigris and Euphrates and Antica 2 in the same week feels like a ridiculous blessing and boon in a hobby life. And so if you have any interest in lighter civilization games, if you have interest in heavier civilization games, honestly, this is more in the mold of a sort of Tresham-esque, stripped-down, highly abstracted notion of civilization rather than drowning in special toys of a sort of Sid Meier mold. But that having been said, the technological advancements in Antica 2 still feel very consequential. I'm a massive fan of Matt Gert's work, especially his early stuff, and Antica 2 and Imperial, I think, stand at the very pinnacle of what this hobby can offer. It was a joy to play Antica 2.
That's Not a Hat was also requested, for it was not played by Dr. Stallone. This is designed by Casper Lapp and put out by Korea Board Games, or Ravensburger is our copy, and it's a memory game. And it's a hilarious memory game.
Well, until it's not a memory game anymore, because when you can't remember...
Then it's a bluffing game.
Then it's a bluffing game.
So everyone has a shape. It's all face up at the beginning. It's all sunshine and rainbows at the start.
You can treasure these fleeting moments of certainty, because they will disappear and be gone forever.
And then when it's your turn, you very smugly pick up your card, and you motion towards it, like, this is a safety cone. And then you put it down, and then no one forevermore remembers that that's a safety cone. And then the back of the card will tell you which way to pass it, and you pass it over to the next person. And now they have to remember it's a safety cone, and they do the same thing. They pick up their card that was face up, tell everyone what it is, then put it face down and move it towards the way it's supposed to. And then the cards start moving around the table, and hilarity ensues. And so when it's your turn, you must, the oldest card in front of you, you must declare what it is. And then pass it the way the arrow says. And then, much like cockroach poker, the player that you pass it to must agree with what you say or disagree. And if they agree, they just take it into their queue. And if they disagree, they turn it up. And whoever was wrong takes it as a point. The first person to 3 points is the big loser.
Well, but that's the thing. I keep thinking that That's Not a Hat is premised on the same kind of scoring as... particularly cockroach poker, where there's one loser and everyone else wins. It feels like it should work that way, and yet it's not. In the rules as written, there is an actual winner. But you're right, it ends up feeling more like the other way.
Yeah,
it's so bizarre. Usually, in the middle of a game, I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at the card that's about to come to me, and I look at the card that I'm about to hand to somebody, and I think, I only need to remember three things. I only need to remember three cards. How is this so difficult? I still remember... the unit designations of various missile types in Macross units. I still remember the brand name of some armaments and mechs for Battletech. Maybe this is just a mech thing. Maybe if I recontextualize this as a mech game, and when someone passes me cheese, I think of it, this is a cheese mounted on a bipedal robot. Maybe then I'd remember it better. I don't know. But it seems so simple, and yet I'm sitting there. And it leads to my biggest criticism of That's Not a Hat. I will still happily play it whenever. It's not a social experience for me anymore, because the more it's a social experience, the less I'm able to do anything even remotely approaching engaging with the game, because I'm sitting there with That's Not a Hat and someone starts saying something and it might be interesting or it might be funny or it might even be question directed to me. And the only answer I can think of is stop talking to me. I have to focus on remembering cheese safety cone, cheese safety cone.
And I'm sure no one sparks up conversations on purpose.
Yeah, you see, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Because that would be... that would be like
that would be mean. It would be cruel.
No one would do that.
No one would dream of that. Certainly not at our table. The other issue that came up with our playing of That's Not a Hat, which is just a fluke, is for the first few rounds, all the cards were going clockwise. And one of the elements that is shockingly disorienting in That's Not a Hat, and this session served to highlight it, is some of the cards are moving clockwise and some of the cards are moving counterclockwise. So when it is going to be your turn is to a certain extent transparent, but not certain, or certain but not transparent, case depending on how often cards are entering the system. And consequently, I found that early stage easier to manage. Not easy, but easier.
Because if it's the constant flow, you can see where the cards are coming from. They just said it's coming to you. But in some cases, you pass a card, and then it goes all the way around, and you're about to get a card, but no, then it starts going back the other way.
Yes.
Now the cards have sat in front of you for a long time.
Yes.
And you kept saying to yourself, there's a rake in front of you. It's a rake. You're passing a rake. And then it's gone. It's birds. It's birds.
It's gone. Birds now. Yeah. It's strange. You'd figure that sometimes taking two turns in a row would be easier, but no, it's not just that you're playing 25% of the time and that's not a hat. It's sometimes you take two turns in a row, sometimes your next turn is eight turns away. It all depends on how the cards are flowing, and that just adds to the sense of disorientation. It really is a marvel in terms of engendering a very particular set of constraints, given a very, very parsimonious rule set. So my hat's off to Casper Lapp, but oh boy, it's so... As I say, I'll still happily play it, but I assure you, that's not a hat will be coming up later during the topic.
And the actual name came up during the game. It was awesome. I think it was a vase or something. It was something that turned a certain way, kind of looked like a hat. And we got to say, no, that's not a hat.
Yeah, anyway,
so true. That's not a hat. Great game.
Got to play Galactic Renaissance. This was actually brought to a public games day so as to show to somebody who's a big fan of Inish, because Inish by Christian Martinez, his first published design before Galactic Renaissance, is very polarizing. Generally speaking, people have very strong opinions about Inish, and it has its absolute defenders. And then there are a lot of people, like the three people who are sitting down to play Galactic Renaissance, who like bits of Inish, but overall do not enjoy the game. And that very much described my impression, as well as Dr. Stallone and Nassimi, who are the other two people at the table. The person for whom I brought Galactic Renaissance did not get to play Galactic Renaissance. Such is the way of things. The vicissitudes of public game nights. And yes, as I always say, when I voluntarily play a game that we've reviewed in the past month or so, that definitely means that it's still crawled inside my head, that I'm still happy to get it back, because typically we have to play it back to back to back in order to get enough data, get enough information to really solidify our thoughts on a game. And so I'm more than happy most of the time, even if I thoroughly enjoy a game, to let it breathe for about half a year, given the size of our collections and the number of things that I have to play. But Galactic Renaissance is really great, and I love the way that it ramps up. I love a game with an arc, and Galactic Renaissance starts off very, very focused with two victory conditions, but by the end of the game, you've got three victory conditions, two of which are entirely different from how they started, and the galaxy is now populated with planets. And the one big downside, I think, is more one of expectation than anything else, because when you're explaining the game to people, when you're explaining Galactic Renaissance, and you say, okay, and if you end your turn with more than 20 points, you go down to 20. You have to get 10 or more points in your winning turn in order to win. And people say, oh, well, that's interesting. Not really. In practice, all of that means is that you're going to win on a scoring round instead of one of those other non-trigger all scoring cards that generate two or three points at a time. It just means you can't nickel and dime your way to victory. Because by the end of the game, if you've put your ambassadors in the right places, getting to 10 points is relatively straightforward. It's not a huge lift. It sounds like a huge lift at the start, and when your first couple scoring rounds generate for you 4, 5, 6 points, it seems like a big lift, but again, once you have more experience with the Galactic Renaissance and you know a little bit more about how the pace proceeds, it kind of generates a bit of a false impression, but whatever. That's not even really a criticism. It's just an observation about expectations.
And you can kind of time it, right? So if someone plays their scoring card, like you said, and they zoom up, you know, either 2 or a little bit past 20, then the way the deck works, you know they're not going to get that card for a little while. So you do have maybe 1 to 2 turns, maybe even more, before that's going to cycle back, that they're going to have enough to get that 10 points.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Managing the tempo of your deck, reacting to the tempo of your opponent's deck is huge because your deck does not shuffle. And cycling that senator card, the one that triggers scoring all of the victory conditions, is massively consequential. And indeed, this session of Galactic Renaissance, I focused on specialists that allowed me to cycle my deck faster. And I felt that to be hugely consequential and very powerful. I felt like I was able to get my senator about 1.5 times more often than other people were. And I do think that that was one of the reasons why I did so well in that particular session. I mean, that and experience with the game system. You play with two people who haven't played before. Generally speaking, the handicap is in your favor. But Galactic Renaissance remains very engaging, very enjoyable. And indeed, it hits all the notes that I wanted Inish to hit, as well as hitting all the good notes that Inish does hit. But by the same token, the conflict system is not as wild. Nobody's forced to take the Gius card and take the hit for the team. There's less of a sense of weird, random nonsense noise through the red cards entering. entering it. Inish, again, to encapsulate my criticisms, was this awkward combination of really interesting planning where all the elements had to come together and a weird amount of noise either coming from random card draw or player actions that don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense, either from this perspective of your plan or in general. So,
or players that are new, not understanding how the mechanisms work and then throwing the game.
Exactly. Yeah. One conflict that is started at the wrong time, or that is kept going longer than they ought to have sensibly done so from quote-unquote optimal play, can throw Inish off the rails, in my experience. Galactic Renaissance has that same degree of flexibility, I find, that Inish has, and the same excellent elements of planning, this time deck management rather than drafting, but without a lot of that strangeness. And so Galactic Renaissance for me is a real winner. I'm very, very glad to have backed it on Kickstarter precisely because I like watching interesting designers iterate, even when I don't like some of their designs. And that was very much what happened with Christian Martinez, and I think Galactic Renaissance is a winner. So if you hated Inish, I would really recommend giving Galactic Renaissance a try if you thought that Inish had anything promising. If you really loved Inish, I still haven't played Galactic Renaissance with one of the real diehard Inish supporters. And I'm curious to hear what they would have to say, because if Inish supporters like Galactic Renaissance as well, then it's a winner. So, but it's possible that like, this isn't Inish enough for me. I wanted it to be more Inish. Who knows? I guess at that point, again, it would be about managing expectations. I suppose in future, to find out the actual answer to this, I shouldn't be framing this as, oh, you liked Inish? Try this. I should just be knowing that they like Inish. Suggest them this entirely randomly. Yeah, that's probably the better route. Got to be sneaky about it. Got to go through the side way. All right. So that's Galactic Renaissance by Matago and Christian Martinez, published this year.
Since we had a new player, I found another victim to pounce the Veil of Eternity onto. This is designed by Eric Hong and put out by Mandu Games. And it's very much get a ridiculous combo started and get ahead before the other person can stop you. It's very much knowing, in my opinion, knowing the cards, knowing what cards not to let your opponent take. And so I was happy to see that he enjoyed it, even though it was his first play. So I was happy about that. Veil of Eternity, you have this giant deck. All the cards are different, and they all sort of create these, to me, interesting combos where you have, you know, X number of cards in your play area. It's an interesting system where you can only have as many cards in your play area as the round. So it sort of builds exponentially, and you can sort of pay.
That's just linearly.
It advances linearly.
There you go.
Yes, exponentially would be doubled every time. Yeah, sorry. It advances linearly. And literally. And
I'm sorry I brought it up. Yeah.
And so far, like I said, it's very interesting because all the art, very nice. All the combos are interesting to me. The gameplay and how the money system works, you have sort of four slots for these gems. And the gems are different values. So you could have anywhere from, you know, $24 to, you know, $3, whatever. And anyway. I'm glad someone else likes Veil of Eternity, and it's getting an expansion.
I want to try it again. I just didn't like how the scoring cards came distributed in our one session. It always seemed like there was typically one card that came out that would get a lot of points, whether or not you had the predicates for that combo, and then some cards that didn't. And so it didn't. I felt that the drafting felt a little flat as a consequence. But I liked the fundamental systems. I'd be willing to try it again.
Yeah, true. In two players, it's very much more restrictive because either you're getting it or your opponent's getting it.
Right.
Whereas if I think in multiple players, it might even that out a little bit. Who knows? Veil of Eternity by Eric Hong.
Played another game of Meeple Circus. This is by Cedric Millet at Matago. And Meeple Circus is a dexterity game that Walker introduced me to a few years ago after it was published, primarily because we love dexterity games. And honestly, although I'm perfectly happy to play a full-length dexterity game, I don't think Meeple Circus plays to its strengths. You're spending most of the time drafting stuff and doing all this other procedural non-stacking stuff. And then you do this dexterity thing that isn't really very dexterity-ish. I mean, there's a little bit of dexterity, but mostly it's just about arranging your things in the appropriate patterns. So these scoring cards that come up and say, I want you to have two acrobats on their head supporting a third acrobat standing on both of their feet. It's like, oh, okay. So now I just need to draft the acrobats and arrange them in a proper way. So if anything, it feels more like a kind of a bizarre combination of tiling and dexterity because stacking them is not the difficult part. Again, it's more the planning. There's lots of charming stuff. You know, you can draft elephants and monkeys and specialists of all kinds. And there's a lot of silly and goofy elements for the challenges, like during the last round, you could have a challenge that said you have to name all your acrobats as you place them. I'm a big fan of whimsy of that nature. You have to say, ooh, ouch, every time a piece falls or something to that extent, as well as, you know, your traditional dexterity game, you know, like play with your offhand, play with one hand, eye covered, stuff like that. Ultimately, though, I wish that it were, you know, the goofy to length to non-goofy ratios just seem off to me in Meeple Circus. I'm perfectly willing to play, but the play time, I think, is a little too long and or the number of challenges not good enough. Because you only stack three times over a 45 to 60 minute game of Meeple Circus. I mean, compare that to other dexterity games where you constantly get to do the fun stuff, or other drafting games where you're drafting a lot more cards. You only end up drafting six things and stacking three times. It's not a whole lot of efficiency, and so I don't derive as much pleasure in, like, watching everyone else do their circus things. In the last round, everyone goes in sequence, and it's kind of by necessity, and that also kind of saps all the momentum out of the game of Meeple Circus. So if there was some way to increase the number of rounds without increasing the duration, if there was some way to increase the dexterity challenge without increasing the flukiness, I'd very much be in favor of. But as it stands, Meeple Circus, I think, is a clever idea that doesn't quite manifest. And so I'm perfectly willing to play it, but it's not something I'd suggest, and I don't think it belongs in the top tier of dexterity games.
No, that's why it's definitely dropped off my list. I put it more sort of like in the event category. Same with like Catacombs or Rush MD or Kitchen sure. MD. It's like that one game you pull out every couple of years and say, remember this? And then you know, mess around with it for a while and then it goes back on the shelf.
Sure, sure. Rush MD and Kitchen Rush and games of that ilk, there's a lot more going on there. And I feel like in the case of Catacombs, yes, it's very much too long, especially when not playing the Walker curated version. But they're at least you're fighting different kinds of enemies, and you're doing different kinds of things,
oh,
and
for sure.
Getting new items and stuff. Again, Meeple Circus, it wants to avoid that by virtue of the drafting rounds, but it doesn't... You know, my second build felt an awful lot like my first build, and my third build felt an awful lot like my second build, and that's just not ideal for me.
Oh, no, I agree. I'm not comparing the games
sure.
whatsoever.
I was.
Yes, it's
there you
true.
Go.
It's true.
So that's Meeple Circus. Cute idea. Possibly okay with non-hobbyist gamers, but I mean, frankly, a lot of dexterity games are. And in point of fact, the rules grid is probably too much for non-hobbyist gamers, so I'd much rather stick with other dexterity games.
And the production is amazing.
Oh, the production's great. Yeah, no doubt about it.
I went back to Mythwind. This is designed by Nathan Liege and Brendan McCaskill and put out by Open Owl Studios. And like I said last time, it is very much a app-type game, if you like those idle apps where you're doing action efficiency for the sake of action efficiency. There's no win condition, no loss condition. There's like certain hindrances if you don't make certain thresholds, but you won't lose. There is, in my opinion, a semi-interesting storyline happening in the background.
Oh.
Yeah, there's these sprites. You know, you're sort of introduced to them.
Like 8-bit sprites?
No.
Okay.
Fairies and sprites. And trolls and golems, you see them all. There's like an adventure deck, and there's an event deck. So every so often, when the weather card comes up, you have to do an event. And there's one of the action spaces you can go to is going on an adventure. And both of these actions will start seeding more cards into those particular decks, and sort of advances the story along while you're doing your little efficiency engine. So the first time I played, I went the one season and then just sort of reset it and thought maybe I'll get back to it, maybe I won't. And I felt like playing it almost right away. So I'm keeping this sort of game going. I didn't reset it this time. And I went through two full seasons in one sitting. And I'm enjoying it. I'm a farmer, Mark. I plant the crops. I water the crops. You also get cows.
Okay.
You put cows out there. And they do the Uwe Rosenberg breeding when you have that. And
I need to learn about the birds and the bees, I learned from Uwe Rosenberg.
Just so. And then there's tools you can put out there where they have to be beside a cow. And then they make your watering and or your planting better. And you have to fit your crops in just right. And yeah.
I'm glad you're enjoying it. If you had to write marketing copy for Mythwind, how often and how many times would you use the word cozy?
Ooh, not as many as they did. I think 37 is too many.
The only reference I have for Mythwind, honestly, I looked through the components. You know, the trays look cute. The components look nice. But then again, almost every game coming out of Kickstarter has good-looking components. That's not, I mean, an Age Contrived had good-looking components. But the relentlessness with which they kept using the word cozy in the crowdfunding campaign, I still remember more than a year later. Do you still maintain that this is a game that I would not enjoy, Walker? Because at the first time you talked about Mythwind, you definitely said that I would not enjoy it.
I don't think so.
Okay.
You could try it. It doesn't take that long.
Oh, well, if it's quick, I'd be happy to give it a shot.
Yeah, you do 9 seasons, and like once you...
Nine seasons? One might even say odd.
It is odd. But you have 9 weather cards. That tracks how long you're going. And once you understand how it works, like I said, I had some trouble with figuring out how you got more workers. And so I just broke down and just looked through the cards. Because some people said it comes through this certain deck. And I went through the deck. And there are no ways to get workers through that deck. And then I looked through another deck. They said, it's like, here they are. Here's how you get more workers.
The internet misled you. How tragic.
Well, it was like I said, it was the adventure deck. So maybe they're talking about when more cards get seeded in, maybe. But the starting ones, no. So, anyway, Mythwind.
I get to play Titan's Tactics. Titan's Tactics is a very stripped-down 2-player tactical skirmish game by a company called Imbalanced Games. It was published in 2013, and I looked, to my horror, I wasn't exactly surprised, but to my horror, the last time I played Titan's Tactics was 5 years ago, which is tragic, because it is one of my preferred quick 2-player games. It is very much in the design mold of stripping everything down to its bare essentials. So some of its conceits are as follows. Number one, no individual unit has hit points. If you damage a unit, it just contributes to your overall score. So you can wail on a given unit. You're never going to eliminate it. You don't have to track damage that way. You do track statuses. Individual units do acquire specific statuses. But there's that. And furthermore, it is also very much a game, despite being a skirmish game, it is about efficiency. In Titan's Tactics, every ability is powered by a card. They're cards, but they're drawn deliberately. You never draw randomly. You don't shuffle a deck. When you're allowed to draw cards, you just take whichever colors you want. It's just hidden tokens, effectively. And you can do either 2 actions with a unit, and then take 3 cards, or do 3 actions with a unit. You always want to do 3 actions, of course, but then you're going to start running out of cards, and some abilities are more thirsty for cards than others. And so consequently, it really does focus on the bit of skirmish games that are the most fun, namely using cool abilities against another unit that's full of cool abilities. And another indication that it very much wants to be stripped down is it dispenses entirely with line of sight. Because do you know what no one has ever said ever? I really like figuring out line of sight. The best that people ever say in a game like Tannhauser, for example, is, they made it trivial. Like, that's as good as you're going
to
get.
Or another thing they always say is, these line of sight rules are very easy to interpret.
Yeah,
and there's
all the
no loopholes whatsoever. Yep. Very easy to understand.
Yeah, I'm tired of hearing discourse like that. It happens all the time. Yeah. So Guards of Atlantis and Titan's Tactics, 2 very different games, both of which looked at line of sight rules and said, no thanks. We're not going to do it. And I have had very little success introducing Titan's Tactics to other people. The abstractions in particular cause some people a great deal of confusion. Again, the cards being able to be drawn at will, whatever color you want, tends to be very disorienting to some players. But I really enjoy the puzzle of trying to use your abilities, of drafting a good team, of trying to use your team to overcome the broken-looking tricks that your opponent has with your own broken-looking tricks. And I thoroughly enjoy Titan's Tactics. Played 2 games back-to-back. I almost never want to do that. But, 20 to 30 minutes each. Splendid variety of unit types, especially when you look at the expansion. Game's heavily out of print, but it was on clearance for a while, so we've got some spare copies here at So Very Wrong About Games. So if you want a copy, let me know. For price of shipping, I can hook you up. That is Titan's Tactics, designed by G. Kelly Toyama and published by Imbalanced Games. Those are the games we played last week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills. This week's episode is sponsored by Incogni. Every time I've been to a bank in the past year, I've overheard someone ask if a recent phishing email or text or other message they've received was actually been from their bank. I get it. These scammers have powerful tools at their disposal, thanks to data brokers that traffic in your private information without your knowledge. The good news is that you have access to tools too. Incogni is a service that automatically removes your private data from the brokers that are all too happy to sell your privacy away as though you were the product. And since these data brokers can scrape your data again without your permission, Incogni will keep getting that data removed as many times as it takes while you have a subscription. Ever since I signed up with Incogni, I've had a drastic decrease in the number of robocalls, spam emails, and other scams from people trying to spoof email addresses of my friends and family. So try Incogni now. Use code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That's code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames. It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be in the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, this is a divisive of five episode, 315, in fact.
It's true.
So we have to talk about a Patreon, because that's what we said we're going to do. We don't like self-promoting, but here we are. We have a Patreon, and we have great content on this Patreon. And if you value our content whatsoever, check it out. There's many tiers to see. Mark does great extra content. We both together do a crowdfunding segment as well. And not only do you start getting that content, but you have access to all of the backlog stuff. We have some...
This is the time to sign on if you want to thrill to my listener-requested three-part series on philosophy. We've already done one on metaphysics. The next one is going to be about ethics, so there's that. And, of course, ad-free episodes.
Quickly on that note, I just want to make sure people understand that there is a daytime NyQuil that will keep you awake.
Ad-free episodes, access to the Patreon-exclusive Discord, and also if you just want to support independent media and be able to subsidize free media for everybody else. So thank you very much for your support, and if you're interested in checking us out, you can find our Patreon page at patreon.com/swag. That'll be that for the next over a month.
Now for gaming news. Mark, you like Imperium. I just wanted to get, how much do you like this new expansion that was announced?
It's not an expansion.
But can you imagine it was? It would totally make sense. How many time-traveling episodes has there been in Star Trek? How cool would it be if you could use these games together? It would be amazing.
You're right.
So there's a Star Trek. Nigel Buckle, David Turtsey are doing an Imperium-like Star Trek game called Star Trek Captain's Chair. And I wish that they were compatible. They're by different publishers.
Yes.
The Star Trek one is now going to be WizKids. But anyway, there we are. What do you think?
Yeah, you cannot have the Carthaginians, the Federation, and the Minoans all at the same table. I'm very much excited. So far, Nigel Buckle and David Turtsey have done Imperium, which I think is one of the best deck builders ever designed. They've also done Voidfall, which was our game of the year last year, and is a really interesting Euroization of the 4X genre. And so I'm very keen to see what they do with it. I like Star Trek as a license. I'm not exactly deep into the Star Trek lore, especially not recently.
You're not a Trekkie?
Yeah, that is the term, Walker. No need to be quite so pleased with being able to deploy that complicated word. No, I'm not. I wouldn't say what you call a Trekkie, but I'm big into the original series and especially the Next Generation. After that, I kind of dropped off. So I'm very keen to see what they do. And I will say the last time that there was a Star Trek adaptation of an existing license that I tried, namely the Star Trek version of Mage Knight, I was pretty impressed at the way they took the thematic challenge seriously and adapted things. And that was under WizKids aegis as well.
So yes, so there's also a Star Trek version of Dungeon Fighter, if you're so inclined.
Oh, wild! That sounds great.
And so the orientation, there's like a ship in the center, and the actual orientation of the ship matters. I've never played it, but these are things I've heard.
Oh, that sounds wild. I would totally be down for that. Finally, for me, Walker said we don't like self-promotion, and that is very much true. And thus, it is with reluctance that I announce that I am engaging on a new podcast project about video games and the stories they tell. It is called All My Best Friends Are Digital. This is with my friend Caitlin Bailey, and it is going to be launching on Wednesdays. So the first episode will be launching on Wednesday, June 12th. So if you want less of me on the internet, I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you. Failing that, you can find all the necessary information wherever you find your podcasts.
And lastly, for me, Defenders of the Realm is getting a completely new edition, a whole facelift, as it were. Very much more anime-ish art style. I'm sure they're going to play with the rules a little bit. This is very much a fantasy pandemic type game where you're fighting back orcs and all the rest of it, all sorts of different missions. I think it feels a little bit like Andor, if I remember correctly. But anyway, Defenders of the Realm, brand new edition. If you're ever a fan of it, maybe check it out.
So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our topic this week, games that make you uncomfortable. Walker, why do you want to talk about being uncomfortable?
Well, I was looking at my... just because I don't want to spout about all the good stuff. Sometimes there's bad stuff. I like to talk about it, even though the last topic was negative as well. But anyway, moving on. I'm looking at my stacks of games, and I see Splendid Veil. And other than the god-awful combat system, I'm wondering, why don't I want to play this? And this is not a huge part. This is just one... The reason why I chose this. It's not, you know, this is not an egregious a thing. It's one of, I was playing a character that was blind and I was just doing normal stuff. And I just felt as though, is this really taking into account the suffering and, you know, all the things that blind people have to go through? And I just say, oh, I'm playing a blind character. Look at me. And I didn't feel as though that felt good.
That's interesting. I don't know.
That's what I mean. It's confusing. I'm not sure.
Sure.
I haven't thought it all the way through, but I just thought, I just don't know if that's a good representation. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that touches on a lot of uncertainty that exists in a lot of discourse surrounding disability accommodation and disability circles generally, right? There's this big, I don't know that I would put it in terms of, you know, the suffering that blind people encounter. That might be
them a little too far. Yeah,
but some of the challenges they face.
Yeah, and the work they have to put in. Is what I mean.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. In part because of lack of accommodations and in part because of the disability itself. And of course, where that line gets drawn is a matter of fierce debate. I remember actually, I was having a discussion with Dr. Contra just the other day because there's a raging discussion in the deaf community about there are a lot of raging discussions in the deaf community about the interplay between accommodation and between integration. There's a lot of discussions in the blind community the same way. Like, for example, there are some individuals who echolocate, and that is one way that they navigate the world as blind people. But by the same token, there are advocates for the blind as well as members of the blind community who argue that clicking in public is perceived as weird and might lead to greater ostracization and therefore discourage the use of echolocation as a way to compensate for being sightless. Yeah. And so, yeah, there are a lot of issues surrounding these things. And I agree with you, as someone who is not plugged into the disabled community, I too feel somewhat uncomfortable any time a member of the disabled community is represented. I immediately become nervous, like, wait, how good is this representation? I just don't know. My ignorance puts me in a state of supreme discomfort, so I know exactly what
just
you're talking
so.
About. Yeah. That's a good example.
All right, so I think a lot of these games and or things will drop into some categories, or I think we should put them into categories because that might lead to some discussion as well. I have theme, stress, and hidden agenda.
Ooh, yeah, no, those are good ones. I would also put I've got another couple ones, but let's deal with your categories first.
All right, so theme, I'm not going to go too much into it. Just war games where the conflict is still happening,
mm-hmm.
and where they have actual pictures of the conflict and actual named people that are in that conflict.
Yeah, that's been one of your consistent objections.
Don't like that too much. Secret Hitler is a problem. Mm-hmm. I just don't like giving any airtime to that kind of thing.
Sure.
They could have named it anything. Why that?
I do think, though, I just want to point out that there are some games that really grapple with this discomfort and deliberately make you uncomfortable. And I think that that can be very good and very illustrative. I mean, three games that come to mind are Meltwater, which we adore, and the discomfort you're feeling there is very interesting. Votes for Women as well. Puts you in the anti-suffrage category and that you should live in that discomfort and feel that discomfort, as well as This Guilty Land for much the same reason. The trick is actually, you talk about war games. I wish more war games did that. You know, I think there's a reason why Meltwater, Votes for Women, and This Guilty Land are all published by non-traditional war game publishers. Of those three, Hollenspiel is probably the closest to a war game publisher, but they publish a lot of non-war games or war games that take things from a different perspective. You know, if you look at GMT's catalog, you look at the way Advanced Squad Leader does things, you look at a lot of the more mainstream, even some of the smaller ones, like, you know, Conquest and other people, they typically present armed conflict at a level of remove where all the discomfort is washed away. You're just moving pieces around a map. And that's okay, I think, you know, for the most part. I do wish that there was a slightly greater proportion of war games that grappled with war in a way that made you feel that level of discomfort. You know, the good kind of discomfort, the productive kind of discomfort, the kind of cognitive dissonance that might lead to reflection and or insight.
Or but learning, the learning kind as
precisely,
well.
Yeah, precisely, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I missed gameplay. That's where I put Meltwater in. It was the sort of the gameplay, because I'm not sure exactly...
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure exactly how the description of Meltwater plays. Or it reads, right?
You're but right.
It could be just like, you know, you're conflicting, you're pushing people back and forth, and you say, oh, it's an area control game.
You're
sure,
right.
No problem. And then when the gameplay washes out,
mm.
then that's when you start to learn.
That's fair. It is emergent rather than facially obvious. Like, yeah. You set up votes for women and say, you're in the anti-suffrage side, and you're really like, ooh, yeah. I get it. Whereas Meltwater, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic thing. It's like, oh, well, this is a pretty blasted hellscape. Okay, here we are. It's like, oh, my goodness, I'm starving these civilians,
yes.
aren't I? Yeah, yeah. So other gameplay... other games you want to put in the gameplay category?
Twister.
Yep, different kind of discomfort. Yep, yeah. Absolutely. Dungeon Fighter as well.
Yeah, there's this game, when doing research with this game, I found called True Colors.
Mm-hmm.
It's a party game, but then it has just like weird questions. Like, you always vote for a person that's playing. So there'll be a question like, who's probably wearing sexy underwear right now?
Sure.
Or who's most likely to cheat on their spouse? Or,
oh my goodness!
Well, that was sort of off the cuff. I'm
yeah.
not sure that.
No,
was
no, but I understand what you're getting at. Like, we play a lot of games like Just One, like yeah. Green Team Wins, and once in a while we'll make reference to somebody at the table as a joke. But if that were the entire game, yeah. I'd feel pretty uncomfortable, especially if there's actual content to it. Like,
yeah, there is...
who do you think would be most likely to cheat on their taxes? Who do you think would be most likely to... I don't want to...
There are definitely questions like that.
I don't even want to chase that down. Yeah, that's the bad kind of discomfort. Yeah, and physical discomfort, you know, again, Dungeon Fighter, we actually had to bin a couple of restrictions because of the knees of a number of people at the table. You and Huey both have bad knees. You toughed it out, though. Because you, hate yourself. There is also, I mean, I would include nearly any real-time dice game because dice will fall off the table.
True. I put those kind of games under stress, right? Real-time games I put under stress.
I'm differentiating between two things,
true,
right?
True, true, true.
Real-time games give you the discomfort of doing things under a time pressure. I'm talking about literally the fact that many games seem to lead to more component droppages, and depending on your setup, it may be more or less uncomfortable to crawl around looking for that missing die or cube.
True. I contest that it's the stress that made you drop it in the first place.
Sure. Compounding the discomfort. Multiple different kinds of discomfort. Yeah, time pressure is obviously a very clear source of discomfort and stress in many game-playing environments.
And then there's that game you play in the dark.
Yeah, so
Nyctophobia.
Nyctophobia, you play with wearing blindfolds. There are some games that prompt you to close your eyes for brief periods of time. Like Just One, for example, is fine. You know,
yes.
Just One, you close your eyes while people are coming up with their clues. That's okay. Then there are games where you're expected to keep your eyes closed longer. Like, I'm starting to think like things like Hand-to-Hand Wombat or Team 3. That's starting to push it a little. Again, amongst strangers in public places, right?
Another thing that prompted this particular topic was something we covered in the Pledge of Indifference, which is the crowdfunding thing, was that they're doing Werewolf in the Dark.
Yeah.
So technically, I don't know how you do it in a big city because it would be so much like outside light coming in. You're supposed to make sure like... your whole house is
shut off all the lights,
black,
keep everything black, yeah.
And then you play some sort of werewolf game,
yeah,
with everyone moving around the house.
And there's a warning on the page saying that there's a high risk of physical injury. At least they're conscious of it.
Oh, and I meant to say at the beginning, this is our how uncomfortable we are. Some people might,
yeah, of course,
love this thing.
Yes,
I would never play that thing.
Yeah, yeah, but well, that highlights a specific kind of discomfort. This is the empathic discomfort, right? I am perfectly willing, but then again, I'm socialized as a man. I am perfectly willing to be in public and have my eyes closed and then possibly, I don't know, combine a whole bunch of things like play Nyctophobia and Tiny Turbo Kids at the same time. I'm fine with a stranger grabbing my thumb and hovering over me and using my thumb to direct a marker as I'm drawing something with my eyes closed. Fine, whatever. But I would never in a million years suggest to a group of people I didn't know that they do that in public. I would be too uncomfortable to do that. Just putting just, that pressure on somebody. Yeah, for just suggesting it. So this isn't even discomfort that we feel. This is discomfort we feel on the part of other people. And yeah, I could imagine being willing to stumble. Maybe not. I was about to say I could imagine being willing to stumble through where I live or where you live in complete darkness. Nah, I don't think so. Back up. But I certainly wouldn't ever propose that as a thing for others to do.
And don't get me wrong. I'm all into, like, I've done tons of paintballing, tons of airsoft games.
Sure.
Lots of stuff outside. Lots of stuff in the dark, even.
Yeah.
You know, paintball in the dark. Done a million times. This is a whole different thing.
I am much more interested in the... This, of course, is one of the reasons why I play board games rather than doing things like paintball or sports. I'm much more interested in the discomfort that comes from the cognitive dissonance, right? So, like, things like Meltwater or things like Durant's. Durant's is an engine for generating tension and tough decisions and awkward situations. Not awkward socially, but awkward because you're being forced to possibly compromise on your principles. I love stuff like that. Do I then want to have a conversation about why various characters did what they did? Sure. Do I want to have a conversation about various principles of people at the table and how those are tested? Not necessarily. That's a different vibe. You know, I used to be more a philosopher. I have those discussions all the time. But, you know, the intersection of gamification and personal values can get real awkward real quick, especially for people for whom they're not accustomed to thinking about it in a more abstract way, and it's all deeply personal. Conversations like that can go off the rails real quick, and I'm not comfortable doing that. That was one of the problems I had with Principal Dilemma. It just felt too personal. It was like that party game where you start asking about what you think about all your friends. No. If I wanted to have deep, soul-searching conversations with people, I'll do that, but not in a game context. Come on.
All right, that is gameplay. Some stress stuff now. We've already talked about real-time games will stress people out. Dexterity games will stress some people out.
Yep.
And like you just talked about, endurance role-playing games, some people are right out.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to anything like being on the spot and being creative and telling a story. Not that they can't do it, but under scrutiny or under everybody waiting or some sort of time or just being uncomfortable with it, sometimes role-playing games bounce really hard off of some people.
That's exactly why I don't play Spyfall anymore. Because it's a party game where people have to improvise in a very specific way, and it runs afoul of that discomfort very, very quickly. I'd much rather play other kinds of party games where you don't have that kind of pressure. I mean, yeah, there's pressure in every game if you want to internalize it that way.
But Spyfall's huge.
Yeah, Spyfall, yeah.
Because hidden role games like that break very easily. And the fact that you put someone on the spot and they have to not only come up with something, but they have to do it in a way that is natural.
Yeah.
Like sounds natural, like they're not making up yet.
And that's one of the reasons why the Resistance, I don't think the Resistance is as bad as Spyfall in that way, but it's worse in other ways. Because the way the Resistance works very frequently is you're going to have to get people to explain why they voted certain ways or why they believe certain things. And again, for some people, that's no problem, whether they're telling the truth or they're lying. For other people, it's very awkward for them if they're lying, so they don't want to be the spy. But for some people, it's very awkward, period. They're just not accustomed to being held account during hobby time for any of their actions. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you know, personal accountability corresponds to how you act in terms of a game. What I mean is everyone should be held account for things that they do in real life. But in the context of a game, they just want to do things in a game way and not have to explain anything, which is why a lot of people find the Resistance incredibly stressful and incredibly burdensome. And I respect that. I like that burden. I like that stress. But I respect that in much the same way that I respect people who don't like real-time games.
And under the header of stress, I put it in diplomacy. Because in diplomacy, you have to be mean. In diplomacy, you have to lie.
Oh, yeah.
In diplomacy, you have to turn on your friends. You have to lie to them. You have to make pacts with people and break them secretly and knock people out of games.
Yes.
And hinder them for long periods of time.
Take That games, Troops on a Map games can lead into that. We tend to prefer the Take That games and Troops on a Map games that kind of sublimate that feeling and make it so it's very clear that everyone has to do this transactionally. So Door of the Lesser Houses in the context of Take That games, things like Kemet or Senji in the context of Troops on a Map games.
And definitely games that don't take a long, long time.
Yes.
Because when you're knocking people out or hindering their play, like making it so like the rest of the game is almost useless, you want games that are, you know, an hour or less.
I would also point out that in terms of just the sheer physicality long games can be very uncomfortable as well.
That's true.
It doesn't matter how comfortable your seating is. If that game's going on for 6 hours, you should probably take several breaks where everyone just walks around for a bit.
I didn't really come up with any games for a hidden agenda, but I assume that you would have something.
What do you mean by hidden agenda?
Well, like the designer made you play, you know, just had the, like the cards and stuff in a way that they were, you know, politicizing something within the game that, you know, comes out during play.
Well, that's actually one of the things that I find uncomfortable about Secret Hitler, because I don't think this is an intentional element of the designers, but very often a game will reveal a certain cast or a certain framing of either historical events or real world events that I think is deeply revisionist. And especially lately, with the renewed struggle against neo-fascism and crypto-fascism, I object very strongly to the notion that the rise of fascism was somehow some great mystery and that it was hidden, that it came out of nowhere, that normal, reasonable Democrats were elected, and then suddenly they ripped off a mask and they were a lizard underneath. That's not how fascism works. You have to take authoritarians at their word, and when they say fascist things, you acknowledge them as fascist and then try to keep them out of power, right? And so the weird narrative that Secret Hitler spins is actually kind of deeply troubling, independently of its association with Nazis. So I don't think that's a question of a secret agenda. I think that's just a question of a game implying something that's deeply troubling.
True.
It's the same, you know, it's somewhat related to another area of deep discomfort that I have to a lot of games. And that's when the representation of women is embarrassing. Again, this isn't a question of like my being prudish or offended at the sight of the female form or whatever. It's like, look, this is an indication. This is kind of telling me that this is a product just for boys and that women are the other and to be viewed as objects. And that makes me feel uncomfortable and I don't want to do it. Like recently I saw there was a big announcement. Terry Bogard is going to be in Street Fighter VI. I'm all about that. So is Mai Shiranui. I love King of Fighters. Mai Shiranui makes me deeply embarrassed for fighting games in particular and video games in general. And so I would rather that not be a recurring problem. So it's strange. Some of the times I really like being made to feel uncomfortable, being made to feel awkward, and there are lots of games that do this even just because I feel like I'm doing so badly at them. Like Tigris and Euphrates, for example, is often cited as a game where everyone at the table feels that they're losing, and the winner at the end of the game was just losing less quickly, which is, I think, accurate. That definitely captures a lot of my feelings on playing Tigris and Euphrates. So even my favorite game of all time can make you feel deeply uncomfortable.
And so I hope I've said to you that there are all sorts of different things that make people uncomfortable. And just realize that when you're introducing games to people, that there could be some aspects of it, and just know the signs and ask and make sure people are not feeling uncomfortable when they should be having fun.
Exactly. Exactly. It's one of the main reasons why I'm very careful about introducing people to even something like The Resistance, as opposed to some of the other lighter things that are available. Well put, Walker. Thank you. And so that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate you having decided to spend the time with us. We hope to see you again soon. Please take care and remember, thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.